gold.
Yeah, we can't miss any more gold. After Annie ripped the microphone stand out of the holder.
I'm too scared to touch it now.
Off to a positive start. Was that you trying to be professional?
No! I'm allowed to clear my throat.
Okay. It sounded like you were being like, come on now, this is a serious...
I'll clear my throat in the middle of your intro.
This is a serious film podcast. Enough of this childish horseplay. That's probably enough childish horseplay. We can cut that now.
I think we're done.
Yeah. The fun's over, now it's time for the actual podcast. All right, hello everybody, and welcome back to The Cine Skinny. It's the film podcast from The Skinny Magazine. It is a full house. Everybody's here in the glorious sunshine at Summer Hall. It's Jamie, Anahi, Ellie, and Peter.
Hello.
Hi.
I said that in a really strange order based on where everyone's sitting. Anahi and Ellie both looked at me like, woof. This guy's out here making some decisions. So yeah, we're back at the EHFM studios in Summer Hall to talk about a couple of new films that one has been much, much hyped and one is on a very kind of slow meandering tour around the country. So we've got Challengers, which is the new Luca Guadagnino, and we've got The Sweet East, which is a new film with lots of cool indie film type people in it. We're also going to have a chat about, basically we're going to program our own, we're going to fantasy book a cinema. Because of good news from the GFT and the Film House has inspired us to think about what would happen if we were bequeathed a cinema for the day or a number of days. Basically, if we get into the Film House before anyone else does. Quick, get me Park Circus on the phone. I've got some ideas. Does anyone know where they keep the bank card around here? So that is all to come up in the fullness of the episode. But to start with, I'll ask everyone what they've been watching so we can have a little light-hearted small chat about that, and that'll warm the audience up for the remainder of the podcast. It's the way that the format works and it's generally all right. Ellie, do you want to go first? Have you been watching anything decent recently?
I watched Next Goal Wins, which is the most recent one by Taika Waititi about...
Oh yeah, apparently it wasn't good.
It's really, really, really fine.
You've
had me in the first half, I'm not going to lie. I love it when we get to slag. Because often we watch good films, which means we don't get a chance to give them a slag in, and I was really hoping we weren't going
to
get...
I kind of wish it was worse, to be honest, because at least then it'd be fun. But it's like, it is kind of a paint-by-the-numbers, like, inspirational sports film about American Samoa, which had the most devastating loss in football history in, like, 2001, something like 31-0 or something like that.
Is that bad?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know a lot of sports.
In association football, 31-0 would be considered to be a bad score to be the only receiver.
I don't watch football, but I remember when the World Cup happened and then Germany beat Brazil by like 7-1 and it was considered...
Oh, this is soccer football.
Yes.
Not football. Football.
Like, yeah, what no, they this call is like football like in this country.
Oh, okay. No, I do know that's
used
bad.
For football, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like it's like a famously low scoring game. And yeah, so American Samoa sucked, and then Michael Fassbender plays the highfalutin coach who gets brought in to try and like rouse the American Samoa football team. But you know what? Wouldn't you know it? He learns a little something on the way as well about not caring so much about this stupid sport.
Oh my god!
Is Fassbender funny? I can't think of him being funny in anything.
He has such a tone problem with the film. Like all of the American Samoan characters are really humorous and don't give a shit, and you know they like pray to God and they thank him for bringing Michael Fassbender's character, like a sad little white boy who was lost in the mall, and it's like you know, it's that kind of like very Taika Waititi sense of humor, whereas like Fassbender just plays it so cold and straight and haunted and like you know sort of haughty, and even when like his like heart softens and he learns to love again, like it's still quite like, I don't know, it's quite this like sweeping romantic performance that he does that's so out of step with everything else in the film. So again, like, you know, it's fine. It's like they don't really know what they want out of the film. It's like an interesting enough real life story that just doesn't make that good a film. How long's the runtime on it really? Like I can't really, like, it was 104 minutes.
And which would be very long for a game of association football, which is typically played in 2 45-minute halves.
I did actually know that. Thank you so much.
Well,
I also know there are 11 players. That actually might be all I know.
Excellent.
That's
a good starting place.
Yeah, I think so.
It does. It does sort of biopic the the Jaya Selua, who was the first transgender woman to play in an association football game, which is very cool. It's very cool. Probably the coolest part of the film. That's it.
Is it in the film?
Yeah, yeah. She's played by an actor I don't know called Kaimana.
Okay.
Credited, who doesn't seem to have much else going on. But that's a nice little subplot about Michael Fassbender's character being a transphobe. And then he learns not to be a transphobe because she's actually good at football.
Oh, my God.
See, I got to learn how to get I got to get good at football. I get to solve so many problems.
I thought that's what the transphobes were scared of, that the trans people were too good at football, so that's why they're not allowed to play.
That's true. That is actually the real problem.
This is actually going to be encouraging the transphobes.
Except only if they're playing in, only if a trans woman were to play in a women's football league, but she's not. She's playing in a men's football league. Cool. She's fucking kicking all their asses.
Okay. So that's fine.
Yeah. So again, like, that's the nice part of the film. The rest is incredibly mediocre.
Okay. I could buy this, like, absolutely.
Yeah.
It sounds like a very Taika Waititi thing.
It is.
He has not thought a single thing through.
He appears as this as the priest of the community. I don't really know why. Like, it's kind of funny how he puts on a silly voice and he's got like a fake mustache and he's kind of like made up to be this cartoonish guy. But he's only really in the beginning and end of the film, like, as the narrator. And it's like, why are you here? You're the director. Get behind the camera.
Australia beat American Samoa 31-0.
Wow. But
Australia aren't even that good at football.
No. But the highest scoring, the greatest defeat in an association football match was between two teams from Madagascar in 2002. One of the teams won 149-0 because it was part of a pre-planned protest against refereeing decisions that had gone against them in a previous playoff tournament.
Oh, that's not that interesting then.
So they threw the game?
Yeah, essentially. But they played it. They played it out, but they just let the other team score.
I wouldn't even really consider that like a defeat. That's
no,
its own kind of
politics.
Victory.
Yeah.
But what I would say as well is that prior to that, the previous greatest defeat in football was 36-0 Arbroath against Bonacord in the Scottish Cup in 1885. So take that, Taika.
Taika Waititi.
Where's our
bammed
film?
Up. That's a film set in 1880s Arbroath.
What's the team Bonacord? I've never heard of this team.
Bonacord is I believe, a brand of soft drink.
I was going to say, isn't it a ginger ale?
It is a brand of artisanal soft drink, and it is also a place kind of near Aberdeen, I want to say.
Ah.
Oh, is that what it's named after? I thought it was named after the French language. But no.
No, I believe it is named after the
Aberdeen.
The area near Aberdeen.
Okay.
Bonacord Football Club, nicknamed the Bons. Any Scottish football heads listening will find that quite funny. Jamie. But there won't be many of them, so they'll have either got it first time or they'll have just moved on with their day. Jamie, what have you got for me?
I saw at the weekend Civil War, the new Alex Garland film. I was quite excited to see it. But I thought it was quite a bad movie, actually. I did not like it at all.
I was quite excited to see it. I shouldn't have been, because it was rubbish.
Yeah, because I like all the people in it. I have liked Alex Garland films in the past. Well, some of them anyway. But yeah, this was just a complete misfire. Like, it has the vibe of like a zombie movie. It has that kind of post-apocalyptic vibe, but has none of the fun of it. It's just a really depressing movie without... It doesn't really say anything. That's the frustrating thing. It's like, maybe we're going to get into this later with another film, but the politics are so confused that I found it frustrating. And then it has the most annoying characters I've ever seen on screen, especially the main character who is played by Kaylee Spaney, who I've never actually seen before, but she's Priscilla. Yeah, that's her kind of main role.
Priscilla, haven't you?
I haven't seen Priscilla, actually, no. And nothing against the actor, but the character is so frustratingly annoying. There's just a kind of something misogynistic about the whole thing. Like, Kristen Dust's character is treated so badly in the whole movie. It really doesn't have a clue about journalism. It has all these journalists who are like meant to be like covering this war. Nobody files a bit of copy. Nobody calls their editor. You never see it at a laptop. It's really silly.
This one bit where she's like uploading it to Dropbox. That was actually very relatable.
Oh, you've seen it.
And the Wi-Fi isn't working.
Yeah. It's more interested in like a photographer, like what it's like to be a war photographer. And it captures quite well. But otherwise, I just thought it was a bad film. Like, it has a couple of good scenes. Like, there's a scene where, what's his name now? I forgot his name.
The main guy?
Kristen Stewart's husband.
Cousin Dunst's husband. I don't think it's her husband. God.
Boyfriend.
Okay, so it's not Kristen Stewart and it's not her husband. But trifling details aside.
I think it's just her colleague.
What's he called?
Wagner Moura.
No, not Joel. Her literal partner in life. What's his name? He's like her
Jesse Plemons.
Jesse Plemons, yes.
Oh! Okay, yeah, he is her husband.
The scene with him is fantastic. He's just like, he brings like a different energy to the whole film, like very menacing. I hope you can cut out all the bits.
Do you ever think it might be possible to know too much about films?
I have not prepared
to the point where you're building like a scaffolding around what's going on. You know, Kirsten Stewart's husband. What?
Anyway. It's a bad film. It's really, it's just a missed opportunity. I think it'd be great to see a filmmaker chat, like, make a film about this subject at this moment, especially with what's happening in America and, like, you've got an election this year. It could have been really interesting, but this is just kind of really toothless, really, really dull. And yeah, it's just got some horrible characters that make no sense to me.
The main thing I have experienced with Civil War is that there are two billboards outside my flat, like across the street, and one of them has just been taken on with a big Civil War billboard, and it has all of these really over-the-top quotes, like, great, unmissable, the quotes are massive, it is far too small at any distance to read who they are attributed to. Either this is very, very good meta, like, again, building a scaffolding around the film, or it might simply be someone's at it with the ad design. Yeah. And the great thing is, we'll never know.
It has had some good reviews. Like, I went in quite excited. Like, and I didn't like Men, his last film, but I've liked his other stuff.
Who among us?
Truly.
But yeah, this is a weird one.
Yeah, I agree. I also saw it. I thought it was quite weird. It's very, like... It's one of those films where it's trying to be politically neutral as a political point. So you never find out really what the Civil War is about. And like the whole point of it is that these states have seceded, California and Texas, which I'm like, how are they fucking communicating? What about all the states in between? Like, it's just like so weird. Like the world building is never really done.
They've succeeded from the Union, but they then also made their own union.
Yeah, called the like United Western Front.
Yeah. Okay.
But then they're not in the wet. Like
that's
one of
dumb.
Yeah, I don't know. I found that like quite confusing.
Yeah, I guess it's like the implication is that the current leader is so fascist that this kind of red state and blue state have joined together and say this cannot stand. That's
See,
kind of
it would be great if they explained that.
I think that's what it's implying. But like, yeah, it's not really, doesn't really dig into it.
It doesn't go into it at all. Like it's not about the Civil War in any way, really. It is just about like photojournalism, actually, as a film. Which I don't think really works. More than anything, I thought it just wasn't like an Alex Garland film. Like if I think of Annihilation and just how like creative and horrible it is, this just felt so like middle of the road in terms of filmmaking. But Kirsten Dunst, oh sorry, Kirsten Stewart. Amazing. She's so good.
She's so good, but do you not find her character so badly? Like, there's a 20-minute period where she has a breakdown, and I was just shouting at the screen, like, why is she not like doing anything? Why is she like suddenly became like?
Yeah.
Were you in the cinema?
It's a film where like I'm just getting angry with the characters. Like there's a whole kind of, it's almost like a All About Eve kind of situation as well, because there's this young up and coming ingenue photographer who she takes under her wing almost. Who sort of like succeeds her in a way, and sort of like gets the chops and sort of like is becomes like has nerves of steel at the kind of crucial moment, and Kirsten Dunst falls apart. But I was asking, why does she fall apart? I don't understand. This is like a woman who we've been told has been to a million wars, has seen a million things. Why is she suddenly like a wreck? It just didn't make sense. Her character.
No, it's not a very good film, unfortunately.
Have you seen anything good, Annie?
I've watched a lot of How I Met Your Mother.
Excellent.
Yeah, which is actually really good.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Favorite character?
Ooh. Maybe Marshall. I love Marshall. I do really like Ted. I have a lot of thoughts about Ted Mosby. I'm very pro Ted Mosby, which I know is an unpopular opinion. But I like them all. I love Ted and Barney together. I think they're really sexy. I'm at the part where they're starting to like have their little thing. And that's quite nice.
I like Crystal. Is it Crystal?
No.
But that's a
Where's
the Canadian one?
Kristen.
Robin.
Crystal. Jeremy.
Anyway, I love her so much for God, dude.
Justice for Crystal.
Oh, no, is that not her pop star character, maybe?
No, that's Robin Sparkles.
Robin Sparkles, okay. Sparkles, crystals.
Yeah, 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 I get it now. It's less insane.
Truly the most beautiful mind of all.
What have you been watching?
I watched Men in Black at the weekend. That's, and I think nice. Everyone should go back and watch it just for Vincent D'Onofrio's performance as the man who gets possessed by the giant space bug. Mm-hmm. It's just a masterclass of physical acting. He moves around like all of his limbs. Do you ever play the online browser game Quop? Yes. Where you have to control all of the individual leg joints in a 100-meter runner? You have to control like the upper
calf and then the knee and then different, and it's like the point is that you're using a different key for each one, so it's incredibly difficult.
Oh, that's so stressful.
You do a 100-meter sprint and it takes like an hour to complete the game.
Yeah. But tell you what, D'Onofrio is like a gold tier Quop player, and also he just has so many moments. The thing that I find one of the funniest things in the world is just someone walking up to something and punching straight through. He has to break into a jewelry store and just walks up to it in his shambling, possessed way and then just punches the biggest hole in the window. Hilarious. And then it turned out that Will Smith came out with J Balvin at Coachella at the weekend and did the Men in Black song.
Aww.
So it turns out that I'm bang on trend.
Very timely, Peter.
I know, I can't help it. Okay, so first film for this week is The Sweet East. So Lillian is a high school student on a school trip to Washington, D.C. when their school night out is interrupted by a conspiracy theorist with a bad tash and a gun. This sets Lillian off on a journey across a bit of America where she's going to meet crusty activists, far-right professors, odd filmmakers with great haircuts, and various other people in that country they call the United States of America. It's the debut film by frequent Safdie Brothers collaborator Sean Price Williams, and it has a cavalcade of kind of cool indie film people in it. So Talia Ryder plays Lillian, Simon Rex from Red Rocket is in it, Iowa Dabiri from The Bear, Jacob Elordi from Off of Saltburn, Earl Cave, Jeremy O'Harris, Reese Shah, and a bunch of other people in smaller parts in a film that kind of wheedles its way. Is wheedle the right word? I'm going to go with it. That sort of wheedles its way around America in a very kind of pastoral, lovely film visual. I've run out of words.
Yeah,
I was doing fair. Well. I stumbled on Weedle and I just decided to power through.
Yeah, and pastoral was good as well.
Yeah, pastoral worked quite well, yeah, actually. It really did. But then I didn't have anything to follow up with. If I'd stopped it, I could have done that thing that people do where they sometimes just stop on a word like pastoral, full stop, end of sentence, end of paragraph, and people are like, brilliant. So inventive. So Jamie.
Should you start with me? Because I guess I'm like, I could start if you want, but like, because I've seen Chat Challenges, so.
Anahi. I like this 4 o'clock recording slot. It's good. Yeah. It's good fun.
I feel like everyone's
got like a nice, yeah, nice vibe to them. And right, this is genuinely good podcasting because this film's all about vibe, isn't it? Really?
It is.
Bang. There you go.
There's your segue.
Booyah.
There's your ending. Exactly. I don't really have much to say. I thought this film was quite boring, to be honest.
You should have came to me.
I'm so sorry. I was really excited about it. I think its cast is really cool. I love Talia Ryder in Never Really, Sometimes Always. I thought that was one of the best films of like its year, of like the last few years. Simon Rex was in that sexy one. What was it called? The porn one.
Red Rocket.
Thank you. Yeah, he was great in that. Iyo Edebiri obviously has my whole heart. Jacob Elordi is very tall and therefore great. So like, I was really, really hyped. I thought it was a really cool cast. But it's like, you know that bit in like Parks and Rec where Audrey Plaza's character is like talking to her two boyfriends that are like dating each other. And she's like, why does everything we have to do be cloaked in like 12 layers of irony? And that is what I felt about this film. Like at no point did it feel like, and I get that it's a satire, but at no point could I really get what it was even satirizing. And there was like no real connection with the characters. They just kept waltzing around from place to place. I couldn't really follow it. I just spent like a reasonable amount of time on the How I Met Your Mother Reddit. So every now and then I'd be like, why are they here? I was just like so checked out and I didn't want to be. I was really, really excited for this. But yeah, its politics are kind of weird. Like it meets these kind of, I think it's like kind of similar to Civil War. It's a film that's trying to say something, quote, about the state of America, and it just has nothing to say. Like its whole thing is kind of like, oh, isn't it a bit like chaotic and weird? And that's its whole politics. And that's actually not that interesting. at all. So yeah, it looks really beautiful. Like, I think it's shot in 16mm. Yeah, 16mm. So it's like really grainy. It does have this very like, yeah, like pastoral, very like sun bleached look. It's maybe trying to be like a kind of ironic American Honey, maybe. Like, I don't know. It feels like it's drawing on so many influences and it's not actually doing or saying anything at all. And yeah, I find it quite a hard film to talk about because it feels like it left no impression on me whatsoever. I don't know if that's maybe just a bit mean, but...
Yeah. I know you mean about the politics. I took it as... Like, I actually found it kind of refreshing because so many times when you watch a satire, it's so kind of weighted to one side that it's almost preaching to the converted. Like, usually the satire is like from the left making fun of the right. This was actually kind of challenged me a little bit because it's like making fun of everyone, and it's like, and I mean, I guess that is not like it's a kind of nihilistic position. Like, everyone's, you know, the left is an idiot, the right's an idiot. You know, MD, who's in a kind of ideological bubble, you know, deserves my ridicule, and it kind of goes into these bubbles and shows that the people within them really, you know, are kind of hypocrites. You know, that's the kind of suggestion. Everyone that Talia comes across, she kind of joins their circle, but quickly realizes that the people in that circle really are pretty shallow and sort of are, you know, even, you know, if anything, the person with the depth is the kind of proto-fascist Nazi loving professor. You know, he's the one who comes across with actually a bit of depth. But every other character is kind of shallow and sort of like, you know, kind of ridiculous. But yeah, so it's kind of poking fun at everyone, which I can see is a kind of not really taking a stance anywhere, you know. So like, yeah, it is a bit tricky to kind of nail it down politically. But I think it's got the problem that a lot of kind of episodic films has, that some of the episodes are just more enjoyable than others. Yeah. And I feel like one issue for the film is I think the first half is much better than the second half. Like, I feel like kind of loses a bit of energy as it goes along. But I thought Tyler Ryder's fantastic. She's like, the film really, like, and it's an interesting character because she's like a cipher. You don't really know what the character is. She kind of shifts as she goes from this group to group. She'll borrow like backstory from previous whatever kind of clan she was in, and she'll use that as her new kind of persona. And she's kind of like, you know, she's walking through manipulating everyone, using her sexuals. You know, everybody wants to have sex with her, and she kind of manipulates everyone using that. But she's very charismatic. I maybe that's why I was thinking of Kristen Stewart, because that's who she reminds me of. Like, in terms of her, it's a very kind of laid back, loose, naturalistic performance. You know, she has like a kind of ironic, like, she seems above everyone, and I think she's perfect for this because the film is kind of above everyone. It's kind of like making fun of everyone, and she kind of like moves through the film in that way. But I like, in terms of the sense of humor, I thought actually it was very funny. Like, I did laugh a lot. I found that kind of ironic. It's not like obvious jokes, but it's kind of, everything's a bit kind of like world weary and sort of sarcastic, which I enjoyed. So there's like things that I really liked about this film and sections that I loved. Like I feel like the Simon Rex section could have been a whole film and would have been maybe more interesting than some of the other sections. But on the whole, yeah, I kind of enjoyed this ride. And I think what I liked about it most is it's a film that's clearly just made by people who wanted to make this particular film. There's been no kind of input from the studio. You know, it's just an idiosyncratic, truly independent movie. The kind that we don't really see that much anymore, you know. Like, Williams is actually quite interesting. The films he's made, like, you know, with the Safdies, with Alex Ross Perry, I would put this in that kind of category. It's a truly independent film, which has a kind of really cool sensibility in terms of its look. It could have had a stronger political sensibility. That's maybe my one complaint, but I think its sensibility is essentially everything's fucked, which is, you know, is not maybe a stance, but it's saying something at least, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
I agree. I mean, it reminded me a lot of Hello Darkness, which we covered earlier on the pod, in the same sense that it's a satire that kind of struggles with the clarity of its target, but also it really seems to enjoy its own vulgarity, and it's actually quite entertaining to watch. But whereas Hello Darkness was more about, you know, montage and editing, this is more about performances and really vivid performances from really talented actors. But I agree that from a filmmaking standpoint, it it has a bit of confusion about where its influences are coming from. What it reminded me of, which I've not seen anyone else mention on like Letterboxd or anything, like it reminded me of Fritz the Cat, the animated cult film about like this irreverent sort of cat that goes on an adventure across the political spectrum of countercultural America. Whereas Fritz the Cat veers more right wing, this is, like you say, more centrist and more just trying to take the piss out of everybody. And yet, despite the fact that this is a live action film, it manages to be just as cartoony. I think that's probably because of Sean Price-Williams' background as a cinematographer. Like, I remember when we covered Funny Pages only a couple of years ago on the podcast, and the, you know, these really like garish close-ups where everyone looks really graphic and weird and like in your face. And yeah, like that I think really suits the film with this. It opens with this very like chaotic, manic, you know, down one rabbit hole into another, and then it sort of smooths out throughout it. But yeah, I mean, as someone who's not American, I don't really know for certain how much it'll hit with Americans, because obviously that's the very subject that it's satirizing. But I still think that it's an interesting enough film to go and see, just to check in with what American cinema, American independent cinema is doing right now, and just to see what the vibe is on the other side of the Atlantic. Hint, not good.
Yeah, bad. The vibes are off.
I wish people would stop calling things satire that aren't satire.
Yeah, like, there is also that.
Just make a film that's about someone who's like, I'm hot, but I'm also cool. Isn't that ironic? Like, just wandering around for an hour and 40 minutes doing that, because like, it doesn't then also need to be a kind of like state of the nation take, because what you end up doing, if you're trying to do like a kind of nihilist podcaster's like take on the state of America, is you're like, who should we make the most sympathetic character? The Nazi pedo. Like, that's not a good idea. That's not a good idea at all. But I think it does look great. It is very well cast. The actors are all very good, and they all really fill their roles. No one feels like miscast or out of place. Yeah, like you say, slightly sus politics, character motivations mixed to unclear, a lot of, you know, I did this because in order, once I do this bit, then the next bit of the script will happen. A lot of that kind of energy. A lot of like, why has this happened? Because this is a film and that's what's written down.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Like, we need to get to the next bit. Yeah,
the script says we need to go into the next bit. So it says, I do this. Well, I mean, it's what it says here. Yeah, when you're following the directions on a sat nav and you're like, doesn't look like I should go down there, but apparently that's going to tip me straight home.
Yeah, I was going to say, whoever's cast it was like right on the button, because I think it was, I presume that some of it was shot a while ago, because like now a lot of the people in it are super famous and they would no way could they afford to have them. So like whoever's cast it sort of had the finger on the pulse of who was going to be the next hot thing, you know? Mm. So like it's not just Jacob Lord, there's loads of like young, talented, up and coming talent.
There is also one incredible sequence that is like incredible both in the sense of being a big surprise and also kind of not credible in terms of like the things that are implied by this sequence that occurs about 2/3 of the way through the film that I don't want to spoil, so we'll discuss it once we'll discuss it after I've got to the end of this bit, and then we can edit our explanation of it out so we don't spoil it for other people.
Okay.
But yeah, I would think it's say probably worth going to see it just for that thing I've very loosely alluded to. You know what? That's a recommendation.
That's the poster quote, baby.
Just trust me.
Trust me. And despite all the things I've just said, go and see it anyway. So The Sweet East is out now. It's on a very kind of limited release, but it is coming our way at the end of April. So it's going to be on at the GFT from the 26th of April, and it is on the 27th at the Cameo in Edinburgh. I think they're touring a couple of like 35mm prints, so it will look lovely.
That will actually be great.
It is a vibe, but your tolerance for the vibe may vary. Second review for today, Challengers, the new film from Luca Guadagnino, stars Zendaya, Mike Faist, and Josh O'Connor. So Tashi, played by Zendaya, is a former tennis star turned tennis coach. Under her tutelage, her tennis player husband Art has also become a winning tennis player, but he has since his heights fallen upon harder times. So Tashi decides to enter him into some lower level competitions, the Challengers Tour of the title, in order to get his tennis playing mojo back. And that's where they run into Patrick. He is a journeyman tennis man, Art's former best friend, Tashi's ex-boyfriend. It's all very complicated. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated love. I believe they call it a love triangle.
Yes.
Ellie, I'm looking straight at you.
Yeah, you are.
Who do we think we're going to first?
I don't know if it was clear based on the way I was describing next goal wins, but I'm a deeply unathletic person. And as a deeply unathletic person, I was skeptical that tennis could ever be sexy. But Luca did it. It was good. if you told me it was a love triangle based on hibernation, then that would have been sexy. But
someone should make that film.
It is sexy. It's not as like polyamorous and hedonistic as I thought it was going to be. The weird entangled homoeroticism really makes up like the first act, and then from that point on it's a bit more of a conventional heteronormative love triangle slash professional rivalry slash Clash of the Titans. And it jumps a lot about in time, so to the fact where it can actually be quite confusing. But if you're considering going to see the film, don't be intimidated by that. Just remember that you can always place when a scene is supposed to take place based on the length of Zendaya's hair. Mm-hmm. So if she's got that like Disney Channel drip, it's meant to be 2011. but it is quite an elaborate timeline.
You're going to get arrested.
I'm just imagining someone going to the cinema with their like cue card and being like hair length.
You get a little sextant to measure how long her hair
is. Like eyeglasses in the opera.
But it's quite an... I think I might go watch it another time because I just wanted to get like a solid grip on how it jumps about and how the timeline works. Because we really are bounced about as if a ball across a court, you might say.
Oh, fuck, I see where he's going with this.
I wonder as well if the dynamism of tennis is what also informs the very like clean, bitchy back and forths in the dialogue between the characters. And then, of course, the tennis scenes themselves are nuts. They're like Sam Mendes directing Wimbledon. Like, with, you know, the Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, like, bringing their great techno angry robot music soundtrack to it. It's really impressive. And I think that's part of why the film was probably moved from direct to streaming to a theatrical release. I got to say, if you're going to go see this with the 4DX crowd, then you might want to check for a concussion after the credits start to roll.
Yeah, you're onto someone when saying it's like actually structured like a tennis match, and the whole dynamic is like a tennis match. Like, it's like Zendaya's the umpire watching these two men. Like, literally there's so many shots of just seeing her head go from side to side as she watches the two men who are vying for her affections. So it's like, that's definitely the dynamic. I thought this was like fun, sexy, sweaty. I thought all three actors are really good. I thought it was an incredibly gay movie. Like, it's like for setting up this kind of menage a trois with Zendaya at the middle, I actually think the real heat is between Mike Fast and Josh O'Connor is Art and Patrick. That's where the real heat is. And whenever they're two together, they're really adorable. I love the flashbacks to them as like these kind of 18-year-old kind of dorks who are like I would love more of this because they're a doubles pair called Fire and Ice, and that's it. And Zendaya's like, which one's which? And Josh O'Connor's like, can you guess?
That's cute.
Yeah, like
that would work on me.
They're a very fun double act because Josh O'Connor is this kind of just smooth ladies' man, whereas Art is this just kind of sweet boy who's only interested in tennis and like dorky. What happened there? Just the sun gone.
I think the sun has gone.
The sun disappeared.
Okay.
And it became very green in here.
Yeah, it was very dramatic.
But anyway, that dynamic between those three is for me the kind of heart of the movie, and the way it shifts in time, how the dynamic's constantly changing, so we're getting ping pong back and forth. I loved all that.
Metaphor.
and just the filmmaking is so fun. I do love Luca Guadagnino, but this is like not like any of other films. It's like very different, very dynamic, virtuosic kind of bravado show off filmmaking. Really, it's like, you know, he throws in all these kind of ridiculous slow motion shots, the overhead shots. At one point, we get a below the court shot where they're clearly playing on like Perspex or something. It's amazing. There's a kind of point of view shot from a tennis ball as it's getting knocked around. It's very fun. Very bravado. The score, I think you mentioned, is amazing from Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. I think maybe up there with their Social Network score. Mm-hmm. It's as good as that. It's very funny as well. Like Zendaya has like amazing lines. She's like there's a line that Neela Sartre says, "Decimate that little bitch." She's like because she becomes arts coach and she's like just like bossing this little guy around. It's very fun. And there's also kind of hilarious scene where Patrick, who's Josh O'Connell's character, explains how close he and Art really are. Because it turns out they were like they've been bunking together since boarding school and they went through a lot. So there's a very fun scene where that's explained. But yeah, I think if the film is a flaw, I think maybe the Tashi character is a little bit hard to read. And I think that's intentional, you know, because the whole point is like she's sort of pulling the strings, you know, like so she's sort of not showing her cards the way these boys are, who are like so obviously in love with her, you know. You're never quite sure where her affections lie and why she's interested in one or the other and why she switches allegiance. So that kind of makes it a little bit hard to read her motivations and why things come together. And it does end in a really kind of fun, satisfying moment, but actually if you think about it, it doesn't quite make sense what she's going for. So that's kind of film where it's really fun in the moment, but actually when you think about it on the walk home after the cinema, it kind of does fall apart, the motivations. But watching it is like a riot. Like it's like one of the funnest, you know, 2 hours I've had in the cinema in a long, long time. And yeah, super sexy, you know, like what more to add, really?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, like, I think that, yeah, Zendaya's character is quite weird, as she's kind of the master manipulator of the entire film, and it's never clear why. And especially when it gives you such a sense of scale, like the film makes it seem so larger than life. It's this, takes place over 13 years, and it's about this like epic feud between these two guys. And it just seems like, yeah, that's a lot of effort for her to put into, when it's like you could just be doing something else.
Yeah. Also, it doesn't make sense. Like, I mean, if somebody's won 6 Grand Slams, I'm sorry, they don't start playing in a Challengers Cup.
Yeah.
Like, sponsored by a tire company. You know, like, well, that just doesn't happen. Like,
I wouldn't know about that.
Yeah. What's the Challengers Cup?
it's this game that basically the bad players play in, and her plan is that if you play there, you'll get your confidence back because you'll beat all these players. But it turns out his old friend is there, his old doubles.
Oh no, so his confidence.
Yeah.
So, his focus.
He's never beat, because the whole kind of dynamic of actually when they were younger, Art was a shit player and Josh O'Connor's character, Patrick, was much better. And that's why he goes out with Zendaya, because they win a match. Anyway, it's very fun, very kind of like intricately made, like great filmmaking. I had a blast. Like, it's one I kind of want to see again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to have fun with the dynamic.
Again, in that 4DX experience, yeah. You're gonna be launched out your fucking seat.
Yeah. But I kind of, yeah, I gotta emphasize how gay it is. Like, there's like,
oh, I believe you.
There's like so many scenes.
Nobody has
like
a conversation with any other character when they're not less than an inch away from each other's face.
That's hot.
They're breathing directly in each other's mouths the entire time.
Yeah.
Although, like, you shouldn't say that to him, because do you remember that we might have to cut this for like defamatory reasons.
You rejoin us in a state of mild hysteria, but unfortunately for legal reasons you can't know why.
Just know that we had to censor this section of the pod because the film is so sexy that the conversation was obscene.
It was literally too hot to handle.
So you've got to go see it.
It's incredible how much material we've got out of a film that half of us haven't seen. But then you haven't seen it either, dear listener, and you'll be able to from next Friday, because Challengers is out in the UK from the 26th of April, and it'll be on everywhere, because having been saved by Zendaya from getting stuck on streaming, it's now going to be everywhere because Zendaya. But also Hot Boys.
Yeah, that is the combination.
Zendaya plus Hot Boys times tennis equals cinema. Let's go. And the cinema that we're going to is one of our own design in a weird way. This is kind of an odd bit of the podcast, but we thought it was fun, so we're going to do it anyway. So, basically, GFT is celebrating its 50th birthday, and the film house is definitely returning because they got a big whack of cash from one of the governments. I can't remember whether it was the UK or Scottish, but it's not important. They've got some money. It's coming back. GFT are having a 50th anniversary bonanza of films from right across their kind of back catalogue. A lot of non-English language stuff, a truly cursed double bill. Is it Solaris and Blade Runner the Final Cut?
Yeah.
On the same day.
Yeah.
You know.
That audience, man.
Yeah. Braver than I. That's all I'm going to say. And a bunch of other fun stuff. Calamity Jane sing-along screening.
Yeah, I'm so tempted by that.
The Room with, I believe, is it Greg Sestero doing a Q&A? So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on at the GFT from May to celebrate their 50th anniversary. So chapeau to the GFT. Filmhouse is coming back. Yes, more on that surely to follow. But for today's little discussion, here's the situation. The Cine Skinny has taken possession of a large old building after the death of a benevolent old member of extended family. We've checked it isn't haunted and we decided to turn it into an independent art house cinema. What are we going to put on in this independent art house cinema and why?
Which of us has the rich family member?
It jointly.
No.
You know what? That's lore for another day. Like the way you're like, where's the hypotheticals building for the cinema come from? I don't know. Everyone can come up with their own deep lore.
Can they also pay for the lawsuit from a...
Okay, I just don't understand.
I'm going to have to bleep that now.
Why is our lore that we're related? Why did that happen?
I'm not going to lie to you, Annie. That was off notes. I took a chance and it didn't work. They're not all winners. Right, so basically the idea is we were thinking about like independent cinema. One of the things that's really great about independent cinemas is they don't just show the blockbusters of the day in 4DX. Everybody likes Top Gun Maverick, but you can't just have Top Gun Maverick. Sometimes you need other stuff as well. So we each have taken it upon ourselves to come up with some ideas of the kind of things that we'd put on at a local independent cinema. Filmhouse, if you're listening, we will do some programming for you if you ask us. So Jimmy, do you want to go first as our resident expert in all kinds of films?
Just not the names of the actors.
Just not the names of the actors.
Or the relationships to other actors.
Yeah, their relationships on or off camera. So, Jamie, you were talking in the office about some of the key things that you need to put together like a good day at the pictures.
Yeah, I'm imagining like a Saturday at GFT or Filmhouse, right, where you start off in the morning with like a family-friendly movie. And I was like toying with like doing a like animation or something like that, but I went for Mon Oncle from Jacques Tati, which is one of the funnest times I've ever had at the movie, actually. And it's also, I've just realised coincidentally, all these films I've seen at the GFT, and like they're just like really good memories from seeing these at the GFT. So I saw this during a Jacques Tati retrospective about, I don't know, 10 years ago maybe, and they showed all this. This is my favourite one. It's like Jacques Tati in a kind of modern world. His like relative is like a, like has all these kind of mod cons, and him kind of like being like confused by it all. So like sort of like, you know, radios and there's a the fountain which is constantly spraying him in the face and things like that. Very funny. Jacques Tati and like fun for the family. It's like, you know, it's not no language in it really. Like Emdy can watch it. So it's a foreign film that the youngsters could watch, you know. So it's a very good one.
Excellent. So we're starting with Jacques Tati or Anahit. What would you put on in this kind of like?
Because I think that's like matinee.
And kind of like hourly doors. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have also gone for like sort of family friendly, and I have gone for a film that is called The Adventures of Haji Baba, which came out I think in like 1953. I want to check. I'm just looking it up. But basically, this was a film that I watched, 1954. It's like a swords and sandals film that I watched when I was really, really little. My dad showed it to us, and then we never watched it again. It was like something that he'd like recorded off the TV. And for years, I couldn't remember what it was. And I had like these really like distinct visuals. I remember there was like a plot point about a ring. I remember there was a point where like the guy pulls the girl off the horse. You can see why I like this film. But I thought that was like sexy and fun when I was like seven. And there were like these bits of it that I remembered really distinctly. And I just kept, over the years, like I would just Google different like combinations of things and I could never find it. And then in the pandemic, God bless COVID, the time that I had, I stumbled across it. I think on Letterboxd, like on YouTube, actually. I think the whole film is on YouTube. And yeah, it's this kind of swords and sandals thing. It's set in Esfahan. Everyone there is white. And it's like this kind of like pauper guy. And then he finds like this princess that's running away to marry this guy. And then he like helps her run away from her evil husband. And they fall in love. And it's like very, very silly. But it has that kind of quite like pulpy energy of like the films of the 50s, like deeply orientalist in a way that I find very charming. And I just really love it. And I would love to see it on the big screen. And actually, this was on my Instagram story, so maybe you remember, because obviously you pay attention to them very hard. But it was the poster of it I noticed in the background of a New Girl episode last month. And this is like a really obscure film. And it was just like in the cinema that like the gang were in, and they had like a rep screening of it on. And I just thought that was really lovely too. So yeah, I would really like to see it on a big screen, because it's just, it's not a good film, but it's just like sweet and silly and fun.
This does raise the question of whether our hypothetical cinema actually exists in the New Girl cinema again.
I hope so, because then I can meet Nick Miller. Love of my life, Nick Miller.
You know what? Fingers crossed, everybody. So me and Ellie both used to work in cinemas. Mm-hmm. And Saturday, like, weekend mornings are like a very... Even for me as like a young, as a, when I was a young boy, it was a very long time ago, but I still remember some of it. When I was a very young, me and my dad and some of my other siblings would go to the cinema like for the first screening of the day on like a Saturday morning, like 10 o'clock, half past 10 in the morning. And there's always a very like interesting vibe to the cinema at that time in the morning, because you know, having worked there, that the people who are running the cinema got there about 5 minutes before you did. So there's a feeling of like walking in somewhere while everything's still being kind of switched on and almost kind of like sneaking in but still having to pay it going. Mm. And one film that I remember like really, have really, really fond memories of going to see in the pouring rain, Toy Story, the very first one, in what must have been like 1996, 97, something like that. And yeah, just being, having that thing of being like, oh my god, Rex the dinosaur, my new best friend.
Aww, that's but, really nice.
But yeah, like, so
we had very different childhood experiences.
What can I say, I'm a legend. But yeah, I think that yeah, I would be putting on, partly because I also know from having worked in the cinema that like, especially young kids often don't need the newest kids film that's come out, they just need a good one.
Yeah,
so I'd be hitting them with all the Pixar classics from the early days until they got fed up. I'd be like, they'd be like, oh, I don't want to watch A Bug's Life again. It's like, yes, you do. Yes, you do, because you're six. Enjoy. He's going to eat the leaf again. It's going to be great fun. Ellie, what would you have in this? Because what are your kind of... Cause,
yeah.
When you were working in the pictures, this kind of like early... It's sort of like the reverse graveyard slot.
Yeah,
when
yeah,
all
yeah.
the children are out and all the adults
like,
have...
I do have like... I have a people pleaser down here, but it's probably like the least family friendly of the ones we've had so far. I've always really wanted to see Legend 1985 by Ridley Scott, but the director's release, because though I say this is a people pleaser, it was not appreciated critically when it came out. It is a sort of like 80s fantasy. It's a lot like Labyrinth. It's a big parade of practical effects. It's a very psychosexual coming of age film with Tom Cruise as a little fairy boy. And Tim Curry, just wait, Tim Curry as the most unreasonably sexy devil that has ever been on screen in ever.
It really sounded like a slur.
We're going to get a lot of lawsuits for this one. A lot of different, very high profile people. But like, unlike Labyrinth, it's like dead serious. It's quite dark as a film. And I think that's part of the reason why it didn't get, you know, a great reception when it first came out, is because it was criticized for like this very sloppy editing where like a lot of the suspense was wrecked. And since then, Ridley Scott's much longer director's cut has kind of become a cult film. And yeah, it's just something that I'd always like to see on the big screen, like kind of as it should have been released in the first place, with, you know, a big auditorium full of, you know, people who love just old fantasy films, people who love cunty devils. Tim Curry stands.
Yeah. Imagine turning up to the GFT on a Saturday morning and they were like, okay, the cunty devil film is screen one. This month's third rep screening of Toy Story 2 is on in screen two.
I did work in a cinema and there's a reason they didn't let me pick the films.
And there's a link to Blade Runner, because when he did his director's cut, he used a lot of footage from, or leftover footage from Legend.
Really?
With all the unicorn. Like, so when he does, like, Deckard's Dream, it's like,
yeah,
it's the unicorn from
God, I didn't Legend. Even think about that.
There you go. Nice. Well, fact.
So once we get into the kind of, so another thing I want to quickly shout out before we move on to other bits of the day at the cinema, I want to shout out the screenings we used to do in the cinema I used to work in. I believe it was called Senior Screen. It was for the older members of society.
Oh yeah, like Cameo still has that kind of thing.
Yeah, they're in my cinema as well.
Yeah, so you have, the idea is it's kind of like, it's not quite rep cinema, but it's like not, it's kind of second run films for cheap. And you would get the same, we would get, the cinema I worked in wasn't very busy, but we would regularly get like three figures of delightful people from across Edinburgh and beyond.
Aww.
A Tuesday morning, I tell you what, you couldn't put out enough biscuits for these people. You couldn't turn your back on them for a second. You put out some of those German butter biscuits with the chocolate coating, you will lose a hand. So any cinema that we're running has to have this kind of thing where it's like, it's building community, but it's building community on the promise of good biscuits and more good biscuits to follow. And also, you might like the films as well. Yeah. Because they would come, have the biscuits, have a cup of coffee, go into a film that I was like, oh, they might enjoy that. You see four of them coming out after 20 minutes like, that was shit. See you next week.
What cinema were you at?
I was at the Odeon on Lothian Road.
Really?
Yeah.
And they put out biscuits?
Yeah, I put out biscuits.
Oh, that's nice.
I would arrange
only
them
for the old people.
Yeah.
It was never any, we didn't
that sounds like
them.
Came out your own pocket as well.
I'm nice, Jamie, but I'm not that nice. Anyway, another thing that is good about independent cinema is understanding that people often don't go to the cinema, especially on a weekday afternoon. So you've got a bunch of spaces that you can fill with things that are more interesting than just another screening of a Marvel film that no one's going to be in because they're all at work. You need to give them something that they'll want to bunk off work for. It's got to be an event. Jamie, we need a low-key film event for a weekday afternoon.
Well, I was thinking the afternoon for me at the cinema is where you watch your kind of like really fun epic. So I was thinking of something like, you know, Adventures of Robin Hood or Lawrence of Arabia, you know, these kind of long kind of like fun, like kind of macho movies. But like I settled on The Seven Samurai just because, again, I wanted to go to like a film that I saw at GFT for the first time and really loved, Akira Kurosawa. Just like if for people who are scared to watch like foreign language films, I always recommend this one because it's so fun, so funny, and it has like the longest action scene. It's like the last hour is like just basically wall-to-wall fighting, like totally brutal, but it's like, it's just a film of camaraderie, a bunch of guys just like goofing around. It's like really fun until it gets really dark towards the end, but it's like a fun time at the movies, and it's that's what I want to do in the afternoon. I want to just sit and just chill out with a movie I love. So that would be like one inches.
You want to be reminded that no matter where you are in the world or what time of day it is, dudes rock. Dudes rock, and they will continue to do so. Anahit, what would you have on in this kind of...
Mine is very different. Dudes rock. So yeah, I agree that, yeah, the like epic thing, but I went for, I think the afternoon is also good for films that require a bit more focus or like are a little bit more serious. I should also say that my whole day is kind of programmed around like spring, summer, feeling like warm and out in the world, I think, which is just how I feel right now. So I had picked Taxi, which I think is also sometimes called Taxi Tehran, which is Jafar Panahi's film where he drives around as a taxi driver and there's like a camera on the dash and he like films all the people that come into his car, and it's like meta. There's this one guy that's really obsessed with film and like sells videos like on the black market and is like, oh my god, it's you, and he's like, I'm just a taxi driver. And it's just very dudes rock, but in that specific Jafar Panahi way, which I think is really lovely.
There's very few dudes that rock as hard as Jafar Panahi.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the vibe. So yeah, it requires a bit more attention, but it's still very beautiful and very like easy to slip into. And I think also maybe redresses some of the flagrant orientalism of the morning. So then we have like an equal balance. And by the end of this, we're politically neutral. And isn't that the dream?
The slate has been wiped. Yeah. We do sell tickets for them individually, and that does lead to some problems in the bar afterwards.
Yeah, but ideally, back to back.
We're not going to tell you how to live your life. We're just going to heavily imply it. Ellie, what have you got?
Again, something that's quite interesting and weird and maybe a bit more of a focus on this film kind of film, but not necessarily overly heavy. I wouldn't say it's like lighthearted, but I wouldn't say it's incredibly dark. It's called Fantastic Planet Le Planet Sauvage. It's my favorite film. It is, it's a 1973 experimental animated science fiction French language film in which this alien world of titanic telepathic aliens keep humans as their pets. It's like, you know, the animation isn't necessarily the most like incredibly fluid. This is 1973. It's a very small independent studio. Virtually like every frame is just this hand-drawn illustration, which is probably why it's got this very neat 71-minute long runtime and it kind of just looks like a PowerPoint presentation. But every shot is beautiful. It's this beautiful, wonderful illustration of this weird alien planet where everything's alive and everything's been sort of rethought differently. Clothes and architecture and, you know, flora are all very different and vivid and vibrant. And, you know, it is kind of a dark story. It is about this quest for freedom with these little tiny people, Ohms. But at the same time, like, the darkness never really sinks in because it's just a fundamentally, like, cool, futuristic animated film. And also it's, like, very... I don't know, the soundtrack is very, like, Pink Floyd adjacent. I don't know if it's by anyone particularly famous. I think it's by some Luxembourgian orchestrator or whatever. But it's just... It rocks. It's just a really cool, fun film that I think more people should see. It's the film I want more people to see, so I'm going to make them watch it.
And the best slot they could give me was Tuesday afternoon. What if I told you that dudes could rock extraterrestrially? Then what would you do? Right, I don't really have one for this, but it's all right because we kind of filled the slot with a bunch of long and interesting films. So, well, no, they're not all necessarily long. I don't have anything planned. So, where are you going?
Sorry, I'm going to go plug in my phone. Okay. Is that okay?
For context,
where are you going halfway through? No, come back.
Annie just silently took her headphones off and just stood up out of her chair. And I was like, all right.
Did you want me to interrupt you?
No.
Would that have been better? Well then, no. What do you want from me? Jesus.
I don't know what I want.
Yeah, just unplug the roadster.
Okay.
Right, so things are going well. Okay, and then for the evening is the time that people traditionally go to the cinema, so I've read or heard and seen. That's my experience. People go to the cinema in the evening. Well, where am I going with this? Jamie, you need to get people in the door. You need to sell the popcorn and things and tickets to the films that you've put on. What have you put on in this kind of prime time slot? Let's get it.
Well, I've been really literal here because I'm thinking dark, the night, my favourite genre, film noir. I'm going to show a film noir and I'm going to cheat because I'm of a double bill. So sorry, guys. I don't know.
What the fuck?
but I thought the film noirs are like short, so you can squeeze two together quite easily.
That's not how numbers work.
Anyway, I'm doing it. Okay. Peter's missed out one of his, so there's space in the
yeah,
in the
that's
program.
True, actually.
So this is just, I can't remember who I'm stealing this from, but I saw this like someone in America, they showed this double bill. Just like a fun one. It's like I was going to show The Big Lebowski, which is like a neo-noir, like from the 90s, the Coen brothers, one of the funniest, coolest films ever, but also like a great noir, like actually properly fun mystery with a kind of great like lead at the start in The Big Lebowski. And then I was going to pair it with a film with heat in the title called The Big Heat, which is one of my favourite noirs from the 50s by Fritz Lang. Glenn Ford is the kind of cop at the heart of it. Gloria Graham is like the kind of femme fatale who gets treated really badly. It's got like a really terrifying performance from Lee Marvin, who's one of the great bad guys from like Hollywood in general, but from that noir period. And yeah, I think they go well together. They've got the salt and sweet, the light and dark of LA noir. And yeah, I think that'd be a perfect double bill for Saturday night.
Yeah. Excellent. I'd go to that.
Yeah, I'd go to that.
Ellie, what have you got? Now,
maybe we're jumping too late at night. I've got quite a...
Are you going
irreverent comedy.
Okay.
Well, inspired by the fact that as part of their 50th celebration, GFT are doing this screening of The Room.
Yeah.
The Citizen Kane of bad movies, which is practically its subtitle now. And I'm not like... I'm not super partial to the so bad it's good genre. You know, I know some people are really like into that. I've only seen a couple of them, but this one, I have to say, anything made by Neil Breen. So Fateful Findings is either considered one of the most ridiculous, incoherent films ever made, or an example of cinematic outsider art. It's this, if you ever wanted to see a film about a guy who, like, as a child finds a magic stone, and the magic stone reveals that there's a global corporate conspiracy and they all hack into your computers and he uses the stone and then everyone kills each other and you know, people get knocked over in car crashes, all on the low budget of I think probably $0, then check out Faithful Findings. This is what I'd be doing. It's the opposite of a people pleaser. It's a people unpleaser. But the truth is, like The Room, I only ever saw it at like a big screening of it. And it's that thing where it's like, if you go and see one of these so bad it's good films with a huge crowd of people who are really into it, it is an absolute blast. There's more call and responses than Rocky Horror. Like, it's just an absolute riot. So anything by Neil Breen, brackets, Fateful Findings is probably his most well-known one.
Good stuff. Dudes, find a way, truly. Anahi, what have you got?
So I am programming a film that I have been trying to bully Jamie into programming for months for the movie thing, which is Xavier Dolan's Matthias and Maxime, which I think is a kind of culmination of the, like, we're just vibing trajectory of the rest of the day. I think it's like a perfect evening film in a very different way. Like, I think yours is like, yeah, that late night crowd. I think yours is like the double bill is like a really good pairing. But I think this, like, it feels like a house party, a lot of it. Like, it has this really like intense energy that comes from the friendship groups. It's about like these two guys, they've been friends since childhood, and at the kind of beginning-ish of the film, one of their sisters doing like a student project, and so the two of them have to kiss, and then like a student film project, and then like it's kind of the fallout of that within their friendship group. And it's so sexy and like full of yearning, and like there's the Britney Spears song Work Bitch is on the soundtrack for no reason.
Oh, you want a Bugatti?
Yeah, exactly.
You want a hot body?
It's so good. You better work, bitch. It's so, so great. And every time I watch it, it just feels, I watched it for the first time in the pandemic. I think it was released like September 2020. And it felt like going out, and it felt like being with your friends and all the things that you couldn't do. I really like to see it on a big screen because I don't think it ever got a big screen release because of when it was released. So yeah, I think that.
That sounds fun.
I agree. I agree, Jamie.
I don't disagree.
And I want to give a shout out for the end of any cinema day. I have always had a soft spot for like midnight screenings of like midnight rep Dudes Rock screenings. I'm talking about the time that I went to the Film House and watched Event Horizon. And it was fucking brilliant. Because Event Horizon is not good, but also it is really good fun. It's so overblown. A lot of it really doesn't make a huge amount of sense. And it's very kind of like hammy and schlocky, and lots of people chasing each other down long corridors. But films like that, there's something about, as those Nicole Kidman adverts for the concept of cinema say, there's something about being in the place with all the other people and the big sound system and just being like, Lawrence Fishburne, no, save yourself. So I would be thinking things like a kind of Paul Verhoeven, all the kind of Paul Verhoeven stuff like Robocop, Starship Troopers, that's a satire. We talked earlier about bad satire. I want to see Robocop again in the cinema. I'm sure I've seen Robocop a couple of times in the cinema. I'll see it again. I'm still that child from many years ago. You put on a film I like in the cinema, I'll keep going and see it. I'll just pretend I haven't seen it before. I'll be like surprised by all the twists. I'll be loving it.
That'll be so nice.
Yeah.
I would go watch you. Just watching you. I would not watch Robocop again. Honest to God.
Just me sitting down the front being like, yay! He's going to run that cup. Your move, creep, etc., etc. Yes, so that was our pitch to run the film.
Never gonna let us.
No, God, no. So the the GFT, and also a bit of thought process about how Anahit tries to get films on at the City Escape Film Club. So the GFT's 50th anniversary program runs, I think it starts in May to coincide with their like actual 50th anniversary day. The Film House will be back later in 2024. Now they've got the money, I think it's just a case of working things out, but there'll be more news from us.
What's the bet and they steal these programs? The first weekend they're going to be showing
very low.
If they deeply put on low. A Bug's Life and Starship Troopers, which by the way, banger double bill, but if they put on those two on the opening weekend, I'll be going down and having wars. They're round the corner from our office, it would almost be like they were trying to get caught. And I think that is probably all we have time for on the podcast today, not least because we have to be out of the studio in 15 minutes. But
no, Jamie said it's fine.
Oh, okay, cool.
The person cancelled.
Yay. Well, unfortunate for the person, but good for us. So we just have to do our Letterboxd rankings because we keep forgetting to do them. So Anna hates to put them on the sheet. So you can follow us on Letterboxd at The Cine Skinny. We are going to each say our ranking out of 5 and then try to work out what the maths are for what that means for our combined rankings of the films. Should we do challenges first because there's only 2 of you and the maths will be easier?
Sure.
Yeah.
Right, Jamie, out of five.
You know what? It's a shame we don't do the Little White Lies style, because they do the kind of while you're watching and after, in retrospect. Because while I was watching, this was a 5-star movie. I was like having such good fun. But actually, in retrospect, it's probably a 4, I would say.
Split the difference?
4.5.
I would also say 4.5.
4.5.
4.5.
Okay.
It's a 4.5. Good job, challengers. Luca, you did it. Whether or not you did certain other things, we'll certainly never know due to the power of editing. So, The Sweet East. Anahi, I get the feeling this isn't going to be high.
No, I put 2.5, I think.
2.5, right down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Between literally not a film and great. I think a 3. I think that it has some good points, but it is also kind of annoying. Ellie, what do you think?
I also think a 3. It wants to be middle of the road, right? It wants to be middle of the road. Well, it's politically.
It wants to be it wants to be in the middle of the road, the center of attention.
Yeah. So it's slightly better than completely middle of the road, so I'll give it a 3.
Good. Good stuff. Jamie?
I'm going to go a bit higher. I think maybe 3.5. It was like a scuzzy, like fun movie, I think, with a few kind of dull moments, but otherwise pretty good.
Okay, that's 3.
That balances out at a nice round 3. So, I mean,
well done.
We've done it. Maths. Yeah. We're doing it all. We're doing maths. We're doing legally safe commentary on hit films of the day. We're doing a bizarre bit about programming a cinema that doesn't exist. What else did we get up to today? We also invented a couple of new... We invented a character from How I Met Your Mother so hard that it turned out they were actually in the show. Oh, we've all had a great time. I think this new 4 o'clock time slot suits us down to the ground. So all that remains to say is thanks, Ellie.
Thank you.
Cheers, Jamie.
Cheers, Pierre.
Thanks, Anahi.
Thank you.
And I have been Peter. This has been The Cine Skinny. You can get us at The Cine Skinny on all various social platforms. I think we're going to go to the pub now. People want to go for a pint.
It's the first... it's not the first nice day, but it's nice, and it's like not been nice in a long time.
Yeah. That's true.
It's not been nice
in a long time. It's not been nice in a long time.
That's what a closer for The Cine Skinny podcast. Right, bye, everybody.
Bye.